That's South Africa's Hugh Masekela with 10 Minutes Older, The Trumpet. It is a soundtrack that he wrote and performed for a 2002 feature film that was a compilation of short works by some of the world's most respected film directors. Masekela's music connected each of the movie segments featured in that work. Also heard are Rutledge Turnland on acoustic double bass and Paul Clarvis on drums and percussion. It's Monday, July the 7th, and this is Lead Stories. I'm Yatrice Lead. We're back after an extended 4th of July weekend and turning our attention today to the president, who, from all indications, is on the ropes, reeling from a series of major body blows. The task today for us is both diagnostic and prognostic in nature. We're looking to get a handle on just what is happening to Barack Obama and his presidency. That's the diagnostic part. And we also are interested in trying to get a handle on what is likely to happen in the near future, especially considering that he's just 2 years from making his mandatory exit from office. That's the prognosis part. A Gallup poll published last week found that approval of President Obama has tanked to a six-year low, with only 29% of Americans saying he's doing a good job. The poll, by the way, also found that only 30% thought well of the U.S. Supreme Court, and a paltry 7% gave Congress a passing grade. So now we have a kind of unanimity of agreement on the legislative, the judicial, and the executive branches of government. People are very, very, very turned off by all three. The Gallup poll coincided with a Quinnipiac University survey that found one-third of American voters rating Obama the worst U.S. president since World War II. Obama's presidency began its downward spiral, it should be noted, even before he reached the halfway point of his first term. Polls, of course, are not objective, nor are they necessarily fact-based, but they are useful indicators of attitudes, opinions, and varying interpretations of reality, and often they are reasonable predictors of behavior and action. So with this in mind, our task today is to do our own kind of polling. I'm interested in your assessment, your analysis today, how do you rate President Obama and his presidency? What do you identify as the cause or causes of the president's precipitous drop in popularity? Do you believe he can rebound? And what impact, if any, is the crisis of confidence in the president and the presidency having on your political attitudes and decisions in this midterm election year? It's quite a task today, but it's about time that we recalibrate, because we've been doing this, as you know. We've been, from time to time, we do our rating of where the president is and where the nation stands with respect to the president and the presidency, what our interpretations are of the political reality that we live every day. But there, I think it is fair to say that in the past, I say, several weeks or several months, there has been a noted acceleration of this downward spiral, it seems. And of course, there are all kinds of reasons proffered as to what is why this is happening and what is happening. But you are very astute people. I'm interested from your point of view, because you're able to make sense of these things in ways that many, many people cannot and do not. So let's have that conversation today. We can get it started at 888-874-4888. Today, again, not looking necessarily for, long-winded stuff. We're looking for a precise clinical analysis from your point of view as to what is happening. What is it that we are witnessing? Why is it happening? What is the impact likely to be? Can the president in any way rebound from this? What has to happen if that will happen? What has to take place if the president is even able to rebound or is rebounding? It's a lost cause at this point. And guide us, if you will, in your way of thinking as to how did the president get here? And how do we, as a nation, how do we begin to reorient ourselves for what's next or what's now? You know, the thing that you find, as I await your calls at 888-874-4888, it's almost like you're watching a bad play in slow motion. You get a sense that it's just not going to turn out well. And yet, there's a feeling of helplessness. We are unable to make the wheels turn in the direction that they ought to so that things could get back on track. I'm interested in your thoughts today. That's our task. You've had a nice weekend to rest up. Your brain cells ought to be functioning at peak today. Let's hear evidence of it. We go to Texas first with Sarah. You're on the air.
Greetings to you, Utrice, and welcome back.
Thank you, and same to you. So what are your thoughts today? What is wrong? What is going on with this president and his presidency?
Well, Utrice, by the way, greetings to the PRN listening audience. Utrice, with the presidency, I really don't pay much attention, as you said, with these polls, because polls can be used as well as statistics depending on what outcome you want and who is paying for them. You can slant the narratives in your favor. So those things are not very reliable. But the president and what's going on with him and his popularity or his decline in popularity and how they're feeling, it's as I've said all along, that this president is going to be blamed for things that have been escalating and started all the way from Ronald Reagan, and which has culminated in his time frame in office, that it has come to this point. So he's going to be blamed for everything all down the line to where he's at. I'm not taking him off the hook because he has set himself up by his ineffectiveness, his, you know, laissez-faire way of running the government that he has done. He has left himself wide open. And so he has put himself into this predicament that he is in, and everything right now, Utrice, is leading up to for the Democrats to come back in, get back into power, whether it be in the Senate as well as in the House, so that they can do whatever for these last 2 years, try and get whatever things that he wants to get passed. So he's trying to stay a low profile right now and not to aggravate things because they're in election mode right now. Everybody is geared up for election. And that is why he's really and truly not saying anything. The big ticket for him right now, the immigration issue with his children and what to do about them to appease the Latino voters. So therefore, he's going to try and talk about that to make some action towards that end to try and do something to gear up to pander towards the Latinos. But as far as black people are concerned, we are non-issue. They don't care about us because black people are going to vote Democratic any which way, so it's not, they don't really have to play up to us or do anything for us.
All right, so you made a number of very important points. One, he, for good, bad, or whatever, indifferent, the fact is he's been saddled, or he basically opted to be saddled with a number of issues that had nothing to do with, he didn't initiate them, but he inherited them. That's a very strong point. And that's true. I agree with that. Number two, I agree also that he's not to be let off the hook either, because he has not really stepped up to the plate in the way that would suggest that he is running his own show. And so that's a very strong point. I think I also agree with the fact that the prime issue here is the fate of the Democratic Party, that you're seeing, by the way, people moving away from him. The Democrats are moving away from the president. They're considering him in a way a kind of liability at this point. It's not screaming yet, but it is there. It is an element that has already shown up, people distancing themselves and saying, well, you know, I have to get elected. And at this point, the president, being closely associated with the president, is a negative for me. So that's a very strong point.
Exactly.
So I think you made some very strong points here, and thanks a lot for those. They get us started in very fine form.
Thank you, Utrice.
Thank you. All right, so we have some very good diagnostics already occurring. The president is dealing, a lot of the trouble that is assailing him right now is not of his own making. These are issues and policies that he has inherited or that have come to fruition under his watch. And he can't avoid but deal with them. He has to deal with them one way or the other. But it is important to note that a lot of it has to do with what preceded him in office. Again, though, there is that countervailing point of view that this president has not really made his agenda very clear and a major priority, to the point where people can make a distinction that he is, some of this trouble that we're experiencing is, again, stuff that he has inherited, but at the same time, these are the initiatives that are the priorities of the administration. That is not clear at all. This is very, very important. What do you think? 888-874-4888. Why is it important to really take a look at the presidency at this point? Because we know that it is a midterm election year. We know that there's going to be a huge focus on the presidency because he is the titular head of the Democratic Party. From California, Bob, what do you have to say?
Oh, hello, Utrice. First time I called.
Good. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, when Bill Clinton left office as president, he was nearly broke, and now he's worth $200 million. Well, you know,
I like that nearly broke fable that they keep peddling.
Oh, maybe, yeah, anyway. Anyway, this man, Wayne Madsen, you might have heard of him. He's an ex-CIA man, and he has a site on the Internet of Obama's family's ties to the CIA, and this focus on the president is, he's just a puppet for the shadow government behind him, and he's just basically following orders. You know, maybe he's in a faction that is opposing some of the bad things, but you know, he's under the gun, and we have a society that is controlled by this shadow government of money, you know, that buys all the things. So he's kind of a fall guy.
Well, let me ask you, I mean, that's a very powerful observation, and I certainly have said it myself. How, in your view, has it manifested itself to the point where, in your view, it is beyond a shadow of a doubt?
How has it manifested that? Well, you look at, what he says, and then supporting the opposite of what he says he's for.
Okay.
You know, I mean, he's an actor, playing to the audience, but behind the scenes, he's double-crossing the audience.
So with this in mind, what, therefore, do you expect to happen between now and the end of his term?
Well, I suspect, you know, it's going to be a real collapse of our society. I mean, we have a real bad culture. I mean, we've brainwashed everybody to the point where they can't really see what's happening, and the economy is collapsing. People are we're going to be seeing a big die-off of the population, you know, through cutting down their longevity, or, you know, through all kinds of lack of care in the medical things. It's a devastating thing that's happened to our country because of the oligarchs, the shadow government, you know, that's above all of our elected officials. They're all bought off by this, you know, money system. And we have a Supreme Court bought off that, you know, legislates that corporations are people, and, you know, we're having these trade agreements, the Trans-Pacific. I mean, you know all these things. And we have to find out the ones that are behind Obama, above him, that pull the strings. We need to investigate these people, elucidate who they are, and have programs showing who are these people that are buying our elections and buying our government. How come they, you know, this VA scandal, how come they didn't fund the VA? They don't fund it, and then they criticize it. How come they, put this draconian retirement thing on the postal system so they could sell it off? Well, who's benefiting? I mean, who's, they got this TARP bailout and the, you know, quantitative easing, and they're giving all the money to these oligarchs, and then they take this bogus money, they come in and they buy the real wealth, the public housing, the water systems, and, you know, on and on. And it's a looting that's going on, and driving most people to penury. Now, I'm 73 and I'm retirement, you know, and I live in a small community of 50 people. And maybe there's a handful of people here like me that kind of, we've got a lot of time to talk about these things because we're retired. But I really feel that we have to focus on the very top, who is controlling at the very top. I mean, Obama, he's just a front guy. You know, he's just...
So is this oligarchy that you referred to, is it more pronounced under Obama, or did it begin with Obama, or is it different in your view from the oligarchs of old?
They probably might be the same, dynasties, for all I know. There's talk of the Bilderberg Group and the G20 and all these. They have all these henchmen. You know, it's a mindless thing. I don't blame anybody. It's kind of a mindless evolution. But till we can really draw out the architecture of it, we're not going to be able to understand it. We need names. You know, like a pyramid. We need the name on the top, and you know, the henchmen below it, and the institutions that are involved. I mean, you know, everybody has a vested interest in the way it goes on. We have to show that, hey, they're getting double-crossed too. All the henchmen are getting double-crossed, you know. I mean,
so using the prognosis part of the task today, what is likely to happen in the near future? And certainly the remaining time of Obama's tenure in office.
Well, I can't predict the future, but I mean, it's war in the Ukraine and Syria, and you know, our military thing being directed by these same oligarchic interests. You know, they're people that own the vast amount of wealth, and it's international. I mean, there's maybe understood from my studies is that there's maybe around 2,000 of them worldwide, you know, that are actually have the power, you know, but they have, you know, henchmen under them like Kissinger and other people that, you know, are their strategicians, say, or something. But my main worry is a nuclear war. If we don't have a nuclear war, I think it'll all come out all right in the end. But this is the biggest danger that we have, is this Ukrainian thing right now. And, Russia is said that they've got a strategy now of, you know, first strike. And we have battlefield commanders that have tactical nuclear weapons under their thumb that they can use them if they see fit. And this is very dangerous. Who can predict? I think Putin is very, you know, sensible, and he's trying to do everything he can to avoid a war. And we have these mercenaries and NATO forces in there with these Kiev regime that's aligned with the Nazis. I mean, they come from the Nazis of the Second World War, two groups of them. No, I don't know. People have to start looking at, you know, who has control of our military things and why. Who are these people at the very top? Who are they? Are they Rockefellers, Mellons? I don't know. That's part of them, but they might be minor. I mean, they're supposed to be the guy that was the head of the, you know, the German munitions manufacturer. I can't remember his name right off, but he's supposed to be a trillionaire. You know, now, and after the Second World War, we took all his industries away from him, but then we gave them all back. You know, or somebody gave them all back to him. So these people that are at the top, you know, they're behind closed doors and they're saying, okay, you take this and I'll take that, and the hell with everybody below us. They're just like ants.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of.
Well, thank you, Bob. This is very, very insightful and extraordinary analysis. Thank you. You've been paying attention, I see.
Well, I've been listening to you for quite often, maybe three times a week.
Well, thank you so much.
And you're very erudite, and I really enjoy your program.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Well, there we go. We have yet another series of extraordinarily profound observations about why the president is in the predicament that he is in personally, you know, in, as a president, but the presidency itself, his office, also in free fall. From New York, Allie, you're on the air. Thanks for being with us.
Therese, how are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
Okay, so, the presidency of Barack Obama reminds me of what happened in New York State. Oh, in 2006, there was a big scandal with Elliot Spitzer, which to me wasn't really a scandal. That was his personal business, what he wanted to do with personal life. Besides that, he used supposedly money from the state to pay for...
You have to just explain a little bit about Elliot Spitzer. That's a former attorney.
Yes.
Attorney General and of New York. And, of course, he was caught up in a sex scandal in which he spent a lot of money on satisfying his sexual proclivities, let's put it that way.
Yes. Okay. So that was in 2006. As everybody knows, David Patterson, which is a black man, African-American, was the lieutenant governor. And the way that he became a lieutenant governor, because they didn't want him to run for the governorship. So Spencer, in a dirty way, picked him as a lieutenant governor. So I guess he never thought that he would be thrown out of the governorship house. So he was thrown out, and David Patterson became the governor.
I just caught myself. I said he was attorney general. No, he was former governor.
But he was attorney general before he became governor.
Exactly. Yes. I left when he was attorney general. I left New York at that time. So
yes,
I still bring it in my head as attorney general. But continue, please.
Yes. So then after that, David Patterson, the African-American, became lieutenant governor. And then after the scandal, he became the governor. Mm-hmm. Then a few months after that, there was another scandal where some so-called Latinos, they joined, they left the Democratic Party and joined the Republican, almost kind of like in a coup for the Republican to become majority in the House. But it didn't end there. So when that happened, a lot of things happened in New York with that big scandal, and at the end, David Patterson had no power whatsoever. He remained in the office, but the fact of the matter was that he made a deal with the state Senate, that he will have no power, but it will be another man in the Senate making all the decisions for New York State. So he became a figurative governor in New York State as an African American. And then we could go back also to David Dinkins, which is
but,
was
but,
the only...
But I'm trying to get a sense. What is the parallel that you're drawing here?
The parallel that I'm drawing is I believe the same thing's going to happen because, you see, there's two more years of Obama presidency. To me, what is going to happen, either the Secretary of State will become the president on the background or the vice president, and Barack Obama will have no power whatsoever, which he doesn't really have now. But I think if you notice now, he doesn't really come out unless he gives a speech. The person that you hear on the news all the time is Kerry. I mean, this man is on the news. Even if he doesn't know what he's saying, he's still on the news. And we see that all the time, especially when it comes to foreign affairs. Everything that is going to be done is supposedly comes out from his mouth. Look what happened in Ukraine. And this is the thing that goes on and on and on. You don't even hear, you even hear this woman saying, I'm making the deal with the $5 billion. And you don't even hear Barack, the president of the United States even making a deal. You hear this woman, Newman, making the deal and talking. So I know that he didn't have power, but now it's like you don't even see him. You see him less and less. And you know what? And then you also make that people, he's is 24% or 20, I think you said 20-something percent. The fact 20. Of the matter, as a black man, and they said as a black man, he has no power. He never had the power, and now we're going to hear less and less because the whole thing is they're going to run him out of the presidency. And look, even Hillary Clinton has more power than Barack Obama at this moment.
So is this a conspiracy, or is this something that he is voluntarily participating in?
I don't think it's a conspiracy. I think this is something that he's voluntarily, like Patterson here, accepted and agreed to the deal because when he was picked to be president, and I remember that interview that you had with the gentleman, I forgot what it's in Emily Lloyd's, about this woman who wants to run for this, I believe, the Senate in Illinois, and you ask the gentleman, who is backing her up? Who is backing this woman up? She had been, and you wanted to know if she was picked. This is what they did with Barack Obama. He came from nowhere. They picked him for us to vote for him. So he agreed to this. I believe he agreed. This is not a conspiracy. He agreed to everything that is happening to him. He is a worse president than President Reagan. It's a joke. And I don't even think he's that good anyway. I didn't vote for him the second time. They fooled me the first time, but not the second time.
Well, thank you very much, Ali, for your very straightforward and very blunt analysis today. Thank you so much for that.
Thank you.
From New York City, we have Robert. Hello,
Jeez,
Robert.
I'm so nervous. I'm trying to
myself fine. You do just fine. You'll do just fine. Don't worry about it.
But I'm glad to be following the last caller. I heard her before. She's a very, very, very wise woman, you know. And you always have such a wonderful, wonderful program. And my thing on President Obama and his policies, just horrible. So I know when he first elected his cabinet, you know, we was all elated, you know, that he was going to make a change and everything, and I really believed this, you know. And when I saw who he was putting in his cabinet, I said, oh man, it's going to be the same thing that we had before, Bush and Clinton and everything. And And then when the FDA and the USDA, who he appointed, put Michael Taylor in there, he put Tom Vilsack, I said, oh, no. And now look at our food now. The food is being genetically engineered, you know. In order to get the good food, you got to go to the farmer's market, and it just doesn't make sense. I remember when he was running when he was when Obama was campaigning, how he said he was going to protect whistleblowers, and he said, "Yeah, whistleblowers are our friends." And look what is happening. You know, you look at them with Thomas Drake and John Sununu, and it just turned out to be a disaster. And then you look at these free trade agreements, the TPP thing. You know, these agreements, they only help the corporations, nothing to do for the people. And now, since the late 70s, you haven't had any nuclear plants built. Because, you know, the grassroots said no, you know, and we didn't want this stuff. Now, you got this president putting up billions of dollars to have two reactors built in Georgia. And it just doesn't make sense to build these things because it's nothing to do with the waste. So now, they're using these plutonium-laced bullets and bombs over there in Iraq, and what they did to Iraq is just not fit to live in. That's why you have so many people now still being born deformed and everything. And I remember when he was running, when President Obama was running, one of the things he said was just electrifying me would raise the U.S. standing in the Arab world. Well, is the standards raised? Sure isn't, you know. So you know, I had so many other things to say, but I'm just so.
So you're pointing out a clear dichotomy between what he presented as, or what people were sold on about him and his presidency, as opposed to what really has transpired. So what do you attribute this to? What is accounting for the day and night of this presidency?
Yeah, I think it's like if I was, let's say I was elected president, then I wouldn't put the people that he picked to be in my cabinet. You know, like I could take the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management. Now, I would have put different people to head that because that would have saved hundreds of thousands of birds from being killed. You know, these what do you call them, crows or ravens? You know, and also the wolves, they're still being killed. Prairie dogs, you know, they're being massacred. The Mustangs are being rounded up. Some of them are sent to these blue factories and over to Europe to make meat and stuff. You know, so I think it's.
So, Robert, how come they ended up in the cabinet? What is your thinking about that? How come these people, do you think, are not qualified or not the best people to form the central, the core of this presidency were the wrong people? How did they end up there, in your view?
Well, the way I see it, it was a planned. This was planned. It seemed like people came up to him and said, you know, this is what you have to do because we want to own the food supplies. So we're going to put, you know, back you up with billions of dollars, you know, or millions of dollars. And that's what some of these corporations did, like those biotech companies, Monsanto and Genentech and whatnot, you know. I've you know, the bankers, you know, how many billions they supported him with, and if just because somebody is backing you with money doesn't mean that you have to cater to their whims and wishes. You know, you can have a backbone and say, yeah, I'll take your money, but I'm not going to do this and do that. You know, if the person wants to,
Is this the first time a president has yielded to pressure from the sector with money, or is it Barack Obama that we are all the more aware of it? What accounts for the fact that there is this increased awareness of the influence of money with this particular presidency as opposed to any other presidency?
Yeah, we're looking at just what is going down, because money is able to buy so much influence. Was, you know, when we look at what's happening within politics, when we look at what's happening over there in, like let's say in Eastern Europe, in in the Ukraine, you know, how money is influencing the Kiev government doing what they're doing, because this country is not criticizing them. They might say some mild words like, you know, like calm down, or, you know, try to make nice, but the brutality is still going on, and money is playing a big part of this. I believe if such a large amount of money wasn't put in, we wouldn't have so much problems that we have now. But you know, the presidential election was about $1 billion. That just doesn't make sense. Because what if somebody like me wanted to run for president? How am I going to do it? You know, so it's the money issue.
Thanks so much, Robert. And by the way, I will never believe you again when you call in and say that you're nervous.
I am. My heart is, you treat, believe me, my heart is just.
I will never believe it.
It is. Well, I thank you for letting me express myself, because I started at the call, but I'm so nervous. I got to say something, you know, just to get this. Just to get this off my chest, and to have, you know, I'd like to debate with people, and then they can give me their feedback whether they agree with me or not, you know. So this way, you know, this is one of the ways you can grow, you know. And I felt
very
that you
so.
Are another wonderful person to speak with, because you have so much knowledge, and that's why I like to, whenever I see Gary Noel, I speak with him about certain things, you know. But usually on politics, we have about the same agreement, you know. So I just look to see what other people's opinions are, you know. And
thank you
for
you did a splendid job of presenting your views here today. Thank you so much for that.
And again, it was a pleasure being behind, I believe her name is
Alejandra,
you know. But I really, really enjoyed you, Latrice, and have a great day with good health.
Thank you. Same to you. From New York City, Joel, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello, Joel. How are you?
Hi, Utrecht. Good to speak to you. I think that, you know, a lot of these speakers have been hitting on something today, but what I would like to do for just a few minutes is try to put all of this into some kind of conceptual framework, if that's all right.
Fantastic.
Okay. You know, I've been following, I'm 72, and I've been following politics ever since, I guess, Eisenhower got in. I remember Eisenhower's victory. I remember the Red Scare. And I really think that what we're seeing now is something different, significantly different. I'm not saying that, you know, corporations haven't had a profound effect upon and a deleterious effect upon American political life over the last 60 or 70 years. Of course they have. But I think what we're witnessing now is a corporate coup d'etat. And the difference is that all of the regulatory agencies are now taken by the corporations. It's not just the Defense Department, which had a revolving door as early as the 1950s. It's everything now. And I think we're heading towards, and I'm trying not to be, you know, too hyperbolic about this or operatic, but I think we're moving into a kind of fascistic culture. It's not like the classical fascism of the 30s, where politics was preeminent, and where economics was subordinate to politics, as in Nazi Germany, you know, where all those big firms, the Krupp firm and Thyssen and Mercedes, all of them thought they could use the Nazis, but in fact, they were used by the Nazis. They did very well, but it was politics that was preeminent. Now we have the reverse. It's an inverted form of totalitarianism, where mindless corporations run the show, and politics is subordinate to the corporations. So when that earlier caller said we have to know the names of these people, it's not really important to know who Jamie Dimon is, or who Lloyd Bancroft is, or who the head of a industrial corporation that's manufacturing all of its goods overseas is. What we have to know is the dynamics of power and how it operates. And we're now in a situation where we have essentially lost any hope for assuming that the traditional roots of politics, the pluralistic devices that are available to us, will work. I mean, when you have things like the Trans-Pacific, you know, partnership and the Atlantic partnership agreement, which in a sense destroys the capacity of the ordinary citizen to affect what happens in international trade agreements. When Congress loses that power and it's given to corporate bodies, that's what I'm getting at. That's the new kind of fascism. And when you have a regulatory agency like the Interior Department has a sub-department called the Mineral Management Service, which decides offshore leases and shale gas leases and all of that, and where three of the five members of that board come from the oil industry. That's what I'm talking about when you say when we say we have inverted totalitarianism. And I think Obama is just a classic example of that. And when they vetted him back in 2006, they had the perfect candidate. Here, and I'm speaking to someone, by the way, who spent my early years in the civil rights movement. I was in Mississippi every summer from 1961 to 65, registering voters, and I played a very small role in the freedom schools as well. So I'm saying this with, you know, with a certain amount of assurance that when he was vetted, they were really glad that they had an African-American candidate like him, handsome, literate, able to tell the difference between a subject and a predicate, unlike his deranged predecessor, a handsome family, able to say the right platitudinous things and give people the impression, you know, that he was going to be a true progressive. They knew what they were getting. So it really doesn't matter who is in office. What really matters is the relationship between the person who is in office and his administration and those who are doing the vetting. That's the problem.
The examples that you've cited, let's say the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Bureau of Land Management and other agencies like that, these things have been occurring in previous administrations. What is it about the Obama administration that has made this so pronounced and so evident as the intention of this unseen hands?
Sure, that's the question that has to be asked. And I think if I could just answer anecdotally, look at the role that Ralph Nader played in American life. I mean, he's a little bit older than me, but Nader, right through the late 1970s, was able to influence these agencies through the Democratic Party and through the few sane people who were still left in the Republican Party. So, sure, as I said, corporate influence has always been pervasive in American life. It's part of American history. But now I think it's totally pervasive. And when you get a guy like Nader, who and I'm sure you felt the same way in the 60s, never would have dreamed that he would have entered electoral politics. That wasn't his role. Feels compelled to enter electoral politics because there is no longer any give in these agencies of government. And by the way, I'm only talking about things like trade and finance right now. How about constitutionality? How about the assault on the constitutional structure of the country that started with Bush and is continuing with Obama? How about Obama's love, his enthusiasm for totalitarian methods of data collection and surveillance? What about his sending 60% of American naval forces into the South China Sea? I mean, what is this all about, right? And I think that, you know, maybe he has certain ideological positions on these issues, but I'm telling you, all of this is being generated by this this corporate maelstrom that really runs the country, and he is a willing associate of that phenomenon, and he will do what they claim it to do. So it's worse than it's ever been.
So in the remaining 2 years of his presidency, is it likely to change?
Well,
is he likely,
you know, we have
to rebound?
I think I mentioned this once before, but the thing that really frightens me, Utrecht, is that I think the law of unintended consequences is really working. After all, we have 25 states that are either in acute, well, you know, they're losing their water. They're either in acute drought or a chronic drought. Seven states are in acute drought, and within the next 5 years, many, many of these states are going to lose their water. They're going to have to figure out ways of getting water to cities while denying water to others. We're going to see a mass relocation of people. A lot of people are going to die. There's going to be a profound effect upon the economy, which is already deteriorating. We could see the bust of a housing bubble at any time now. The reserve, the dollar as a reserve currency over the next 2 years could be threatened, and that will mean hyperinflation in the United States. It will mean all imported goods will now be unaffordable for most people. So I think what we really have to think about now is resistance. A real kind of resistance that's reality-based, that's adult-based, that has nothing to do with platitudinous or bromidic comments showing everybody how radical we can be, but figuring out ways, the way that young socialist councilwoman in Seattle figured out ways to get a minimum wage law passed in Seattle. But we've got to do that and do that almost immediately, even though the crises that are in front of us look almost insurmountable.
Wow. Thank you very much for that extraordinary presentation. Thank you. And profound thoughts all the way. Thank you. Thanks a lot,
Joel. Okay, Eutrice. All right, bye-bye.
Thank you. From New Jersey, Michael, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Eutrice. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. I couldn't agree with your former caller more. What I've seen with Obama is a complete, the administration, a complete capitulation and a breaking down of the public sector, and a complete capitulation to the corporate sector, the private sector, and in that only the largest and most powerful corporations have the greatest say. And for his part, he hasn't done anything for the general population, for except when it's time to get elected or reelected. He has no support for the worker, and when they tried to get Wisconsin Governor Walker out of there, and when they passed those laws against collective bargaining, he was completely mute. Not one syllable did he protest against that. And there's no help for the unemployed. There's no help for students and youth. There's no help from his administration and the disastrous course the courts are taking. There's no support for the middle class whatsoever, which he invents from time to time for his own purposes, to jawbone some political maneuver, but there's no support for what the middle class is actually doing, which is they're in free fall, basically. And I visit some contiguous states here, and there isn't any middle class left. There's the haves and the have-nots, and the middle class is just falling into the have-nots. It's really frightening. And
I agree with you. It's one thing, Michael, to say that, I mean, we are clear what he wasn't doing and isn't doing, but I have to ask, how much of this should the so-called progressive community or his constituency and political base, how much of what is happening that is attributable to them not doing the job of keeping their eye on the prize here?
Well, I think you really pointed to the crucial problem. I think people have abandoned any idea, and people just become cynical about it, or they're completely propagandized, they're completely conditioned to accept what the status quo is, and it's just slipping away from them. It was right from the very beginning, and it didn't start with Obama, because Clinton was he was really in it 100% with the corporations, and so it's been a progression of it's a vast social problem, and I think we're going to really have to change the way government is, because now it's a plaything for the corporations and for the powerful. When you have, a couple of elected representatives from a state and one president, these people are very easily manipulated. And that's why I advocate sometimes, I talk about California and the referendum system that they put in place, because it's very hard to influence and propagandize and a whole populace, but it's easy to get to one or two people and corrupt them, you know, to promise them things after they get out of office. You know, it's much easier to get to one or two people, and that's what we've done. We put a couple of people to represent us, and those people, they can't stand up to the corruption. You know, they become involved in it. Even if they start out with good intentions and they're altruistic, it doesn't last long. I mean, you know, they're either threatened or blackmailed or overcome with bribes for the future. Maybe they don't, you know, they hide it, but it's there when they get out of office. They have a plum job or whatever. So when you just put a couple of guys there, it's much easier to corrupt them and influence them than the whole population. But even that doesn't work because, like, they were able to, in California, they put Proposition 8 out there, and they put a proposition to get GMO labeled on foods, and the corporations got their way anyway, even with the whole population. So imagine what they could do with just one or two representatives that you get in there. And most of the people that go into political office are ambitious and they're corrupt to begin with. So it's a very bad situation, and I agree with you. The finger should be pointing at us because we allow this to go on. You know, we capitulate. You know, I started off saying that Obama capitulated, but I think the population as a whole has capitulated.
Now, so, Michael, what do you see for the next 2 years, in the immediate future and in the remaining portion of President Obama's term?
Well, I think I think somebody else mentioned that they're in complete, you know, election mode now, and everything that we'll see from now on will be, you know, geared to 2000, you know, the November elections and then the 2016 presidential election. And they're just going to try to turn issues this way and that way. But I don't think it's going to make a big difference. I think President Obama is not going to make any waves because he's securing his future when he gets out of office. He's seen what Bill and Hillary have done, and he would like to walk in their shoes and follow their path, you know? So he's not going to upset any corporations that can sit him on a board of directors and pay him $100,000 a year, and he'll get 12 of those. So I don't think we could see anything from Obama at all. I don't know what he's attempting to do. He might do a few good things, like you know, I'm happy with what he's trying to do with some environmental laws in terms of, you know, carbon emissions and things. And he might try to make that something of his legacy of, you know, somebody who did good in some way. But I don't see very much of anything coming from that direction.
Well, do you see an opportunity here to basically to rethink for the next leg of the race, because we're seeing the field beginning to populate itself? We see Hillary Clinton posturing. We see Biden is probably going to make a move. We see a number of other people, you know, basically thinking, you know, Rand Paul and others. The field is beginning to assemble itself, which means there will be more of the same. Is there an opportunity here for the people who could make a difference to begin the process of doing something different, just like you were saying? I mean, part of the blame has to come to the portion of the electorate that really didn't mount a very credible offensive here to protect their interests and
no,
to keep
not
things
at all.
Safe.
I mean, we could have a discussion about, you know, like that guy wrote the book on, you know, what happened in Kansas or whatever. Why do people continuously vote against their own interests, you know? Why do they vote against themselves, including blacks and including poor whites, you know? they end up putting, you know, the very people that hurt them in office, you know, that have no interest in them whatsoever except exploiting them for their vote. I mean, I'm sure they would just like to steal the vote all together and not even spend a penny on the electorate. They don't care. But you know, as it is, they're not confident enough to steal all the votes, so they're still trying to manipulate the vote, and they do it with social issues. They bring up different things. And people are afraid because, you know, the corporations, they provide the jobs, and every year, like you presented the information about the post office, they're inveigling against the public sector offering a structure of jobs and a ladder of life or whatever in the physical existence, and they're just giving all the job creation or whatever, any kind of, you know, mediocre or terrible jobs that the corporations give, and they're constantly removing jobs, you know, any good jobs that are protected and that way you have collective bargaining and things like that. So so people are afraid that this is the only place they have to go for a lifeline is these corporations, so they're afraid to vote against them because they're the only ones that can provide jobs, you know. I thought that when we had these discussions about Martin Luther King and stuff, I think they made a mistake in arguing for jobs and freedom. There's no freedom and there's no jobs. I think they should have argued for security first. They should have protested, give us security.
Thanks so much, Michael, for your very, very valuable contribution today. Thank you. And thank you all, Sarah, Bob, Ali, Robert, Joel, as well. Thank you all. Extraordinary contributions today that get us thinking. And this is exactly what I love about this program. There's all this stuff that is available to us if we only begin the process of talking to each other and opening up the lines of communication, getting people to express these profound observations and to draw on their considerable expertise and experience. And understanding of things. And it is time for us to begin this business of talking about things that are maybe very uncomfortable, but they have to be discussed because it's important for our aggregate well-being. Thanks so much. It is a pleasure, of course, and a privilege, I always say that, to be in your company. Stay tuned. Keep it right here. Wake Up Call with Richard Martin is next. Reach me and let me know what you're thinking about these programs and how they're resonating with you. LeadStories@gmail.com or LeadStories with Utrice Lead. We'll continue the conversation, of course, this week. Take care. See you tomorrow.